Okay, so thanks, Liz. So we're looking at, well, we've started this new series where we're looking at the Dharma through stories and symbols, symbols and stories. And we talked about the fact that, well, this is, if, in a way, stories and symbols. It's not we're dumbing down the Dharma. It's that these are the languages of the depths, if you like. The depths speak the language of myth and symbol, not the language of reason. And if we don't get our depths, our sort of emotions and our deep volitions on our side, well, our Dharma practice isn't going anywhere, in all likelihood. We're not ruled by our head. We're ruled by much deeper levels of ourselves. So we need to be able to speak to those deep levels. And it's sort of myth and symbol that speaks poetry, that speaks to those levels. So yeah, so the Dharma very definitely does speak those languages, and so we're going to be using those languages, not exclusively, but we're going to be using those languages to help hopefully speak to our depths. And we spent a few weeks looking at the Wheel of Life, and we saw, well, the Wheel of Life, if you like, is a symbol of the problem. It's a symbol of our existential situation. And then last week, Vajratara was talking about the life of the Buddha, which, if you like, is starting to move away out of the problem. And this week, we're going to look at the image of the Buddha himself, so that the great symbol of the solution, if you like, the great symbol of the solution of the state beyond, the great symbol of the state beyond the problem. In fact, the great symbol of the state beyond all problems, enlightenment, nirvana, the state of the Buddha, the transcendental. And the great symbol of that in Buddhism is the symbol of the Buddha. It's the image of the Buddha, which is completely, the image of the Buddha is sort of like completely iconic for Buddhism, especially the Buddha like seated in meditation. It's the great symbol of the Buddha. It's as important for Buddhism as the symbol of, say, the cross or is for Christianity or Christ crucified on the cross. So the great event for Christianity was the crucifixion. The great event for Buddhism was the Buddha's enlightenment, seated in meditation. And every time we, or other Buddhists, you know, in anywhere through time or space, every time we sit in meditation, we connect ourselves with this great image. We connect ourselves with that event, with the Buddha's enlightenment, which still echoes. The echoes of it reach us even, you know, here and now, whenever we sit in meditation. By the very fact of some of us at least taking that posture, you know, we're acting out the Buddha's enlightenment. But we're doing it anyway, every time we meditate. So, so it's the image, if you like, of the solution in Buddhism, the image of the enlightened state. And so this week we're going to have a look at it. We're just going to have a look at this image. We're actually going to expand that out over coming weeks, but we're going to look at it this week. So as I said, it's the image. It's the image in Buddhism. So if you had to choose one, that would be the one you'd go for. But for hundreds and hundreds of years after the Buddha's life, there were no images of the Buddha made at all. Not one. It's almost as though there was a prohibition on it. It's almost as though the Buddha had said, thou shalt not make graven images or something of what you most value, as in some, you know, Islam or Judaism or some aspects of Christianity. But if there was a prohibition, it was much, much more subtle than that. The Buddha didn't go in for the sort of thou shalt not. But the Buddha did say... But it did say something like, he who sees me by my physical form doesn't see me. He who only knows me and relates to me in this sort of conditioned, time-bound body, conditioned personality, if you like, a temporal personality, doesn't know me at all, and isn't really in relationship with me. The person who really knows me knows my Dharma body, the Dharmakaya. Could mean Dharma body, could mean Dharma personality. Truth personality. This is in a sense saying, the Buddha is saying, well, the Buddha, an enlightened being, is not really just an individual human being. not even an individual superhuman being. There's something transpersonal, something universal, something transcendental. The Buddha, an enlightened being, has tapped into something beyond the personal, beyond the individual, something above that. The enlightened mind, if you like, which is at the moment, 500 years before Christ, was expressing itself through this particular Indian chap, with this particular body, this particular background, those particular features, probably not looking anything very special, especially after being roaming around for 30 odd years and was getting on for 80. That statement of the Buddha, if you don't know me by, you don't know me by the physical body, you know me by relating to the truth, to enlightenment, to something universal that I am embodying, is probably responsible for the fact that there weren't any Buddha images. There weren't any Buddha images made for ages, hundreds of years. Until sometime around the beginning of the Christian era. Hello. Until sometime around the beginning of the Christian era, all you got were sort of oblique images. You had a footprint, or what else did you have? A stupa. The stupa was a sort of architectural monument, if you like, which represented the enlightened mind. Lots of stupas. You had the wheel of the Dharma. You had an empty seat, the diamond throne of enlightenment, an empty seat, but with nobody sitting on it. Or you had the lion. The Buddha was often described as roaring with the roar of a lion. You had the lion, you had a bull, because the Buddha was said to be like the bull among the herd of humans, like the leader of humans. What else did you have? Things like that. Tree, you had a tree. You had the Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment, connecting heaven and earth, if you like. But no image of the Buddha. No image of the Buddha for ages, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Presumably because people had taken on board this idea that, well, if we relate to just this guy as a guy and start revering that, we've lost the plot. We've got to relate to and revere and aim for something much more universal than that. What he represented, the Dharmakaya, the Dharma personality, the truth personality, which is, if you like, reality. He was reality. He was the truth. There are no actual representations of the Buddhist form for hundreds of years. The earliest I've looked at quite a lot of books of Buddhist art, and the earliest ones I've seen are about the second century of the Christian era. That's could be 700 years, 600 or 700 years after the Buddha. So 600 or 700 years after the Buddha. So by that time, nobody could possibly have preserved any memory of what the Buddha looked like, what his body looked like. And the artists who started making Buddha images didn't try. They didn't try. There was no attempt to portray a historical personality, a being of a particular time and place. Instead, they set out to portray something universal, something transpersonal, something even cosmic. They set out somehow to express the state of enlightenment, the state of the enlightened mind. So images of the Buddha are seeking to symbolize, portray, communicate a state of being, not a person. And it's quite important to take that on, that the Buddha, if you like, is a symbol of our deepest potential. It's a symbol of the enlightened state, intended to speak to the depths of our unconscious and sort of resonate with something in the depths of our unconscious that we're not really aware of. It's the symbolic Buddha sort of seeking to somehow resonate with the Buddha in us, if you like, the Buddha nature in us. And what's going to do that might not look like an ordinary human being. Yeah? It might not look like an ordinary human being. So we need to keep the distinction clear between, if you like, the symbolic Buddha and the historical personage. Because otherwise, we get literalistic and we start saying, yeah, he couldn't have looked like that. You know, he couldn't have had auras and existed in rainbow palaces of light and etc. and radiated other Buddhas out in all directions. And then you start getting Western scholars saying really silly things like, oh, it's a deification. They start to deify the Buddha. Instead of which, you know, it's seeking to get an image which will actually do justice to our potential, which will do justice to the enlightened mind, the enlightened state, and which will open up a channel of communication, if you like, with our heights and our depths. So the Buddha, what we see when we see a Buddha image, is a symbol, an attempt to express a state of mind, a state of being. Or something even beyond a state of being, something universal. The enlightened mind throughout the universe, which, well, that's not a bad idea, is it? Because, I mean, it's actually much easier to communicate a state of being or to get some handle on a state of being through something visual than it is through words. I mean, we could say, oh, the Buddha's very wise and very compassionate and full of energy and bliss and all of that, and it doesn't actually mean very much, you know. If you describe somebody in words, it doesn't sort of convey it. But if you see somebody's face, see the expression, see the look in their eyes, see how they hold their body, perhaps imitate that, you can get a real feel for what it's like to be that person. You can at least get a glimpse or an image of what it feels like to be that person. We can get that from great art, you know. What does it feel like to be that person? Or a great actor. They will convey what it feels like to be that person. Whereas saying, oh, he was a bit annoyed, but, you know, I don't know. You know, when we go in for words, it's just quite dry. So it's a good idea. It's a good idea. You can communicate things visually through an image that you can't communicate in words. I suppose that's what I'm saying. And beyond that, an image can function as a symbol. It can function as something that we can relate to at one level that actually points us towards something at a completely different level altogether. So it's a good idea, but it's a tall order. It's a tall order to portray enlightenment. You know, that's starting to, you know, if you're an artist, you think, oh, I think I'll do a sort of thing of this. Now I think I'll do a sculpture that portrays enlightenment. Well, for a start, I mean, enlightenment has got loads of different facets. I mean, which bit? Are you going to portray compassion or creativity or energy or what? Which bit? It's got loads of different facets. And then presumably to portray it, the artist has got to have some experience of it. So it's quite difficult. The Buddha image ends up sort of groaning under the strain of having to sort of take this huge role. And I think what happens is, well, very often Buddha images aren't great art. This one's not bad, actually. But very often they're not great art, and they only portray an aspect of enlightenment. They can't portray it all. What happens later is that different images arise, a bit like light shining through a prism. Different sort of figures arise which portray different aspects of enlightenment. You get much more, you have much more diversity. But the Buddha image is quite in itself quite diverse. So when they first started to make Buddha images, say 200 AD, 200 of the Christian era, it happened in two areas simultaneously, apparently. One is about Afghanistan. Northern Pakistan, Afghanistan, that area, what's called Gandharan art. And the other is Mathura, which was in central India. And they both portray the Buddha as an immensely heroic figure. It's a very different portrayal. The Mathura ones, often the Buddha is portrayed as with this immense physical presence, this immense physical, almost striding forward, this immense physical presence and energy. Very manly. Very resolve, you know, portraying resolution and determination, but with a very kindly face. But definitely energy and resolve and heroism is what's being portrayed, which is quite different from the sort of Buddha images where it's an aspect of enlightenment, but it's very different from the Buddha images we're used to. So, but gradually the sort of Buddha image sort of settled down, if you like. And the mainstream one sort of came together, as it were, which is the Buddha sitting in meditation. There are lots of others. There's standing Buddhas and all sorts of others. But the mainstream one came together of the Buddha sitting in meditation. This became if you like, the symbol of our potential, the symbol of our potential, of what we could be, our inner Buddha nature, if you like. The seated Buddha. And it also tended to focus on one particular aspect of enlightenment, if you like, which is the sort of meditative aspect. The early Buddhas were quite sort of outward going, but started to focus much more on the sort of meditative aspect. Serenity, calm, those sort of qualities which we tend to associate with the Buddha image. So in a way, the Buddha image became, if it was going to sort of focus on one bit of enlightenment, it focused on meditation, it focused on the experience of meditation, it focused on communicating, what does it feel like to meditate? What does it feel like to really meditate? Other things as well, but I think that's a big one. And if we can really imaginatively engage with the image, then it can teach us something. It can teach us something about the enlightened state that it represents, but it can also teach us something about meditation. It can be a sort of visual guidebook to meditation. It can actually help us feel our way into what it feels like to meditate, what it is like to meditate. So, and give us, at least an echo or a taste or a glimpse of something that's being communicated by the image. So that's what we're going to have a look at. We're going to have a look at this sort of image, this standard image of the Buddha seated in meditation. This is not a particularly standard image, but it happens to be very big. And we've got it. And it's actually not bad, whereas, to be honest, an awful lot of Buddha images, you have to use your imagination quite seriously. You have to put the meaning in, you have to really put the meaning in yourself. Whereas this one actually is quite good. So I'm not going to sort of rigorously stick to this one, but at least I've got a visual aid. I would have felt a little bit sort of talking about a symbol without having any sort of visual aid might have felt a little bit strange. So let's have a look at this symbol in visual terms. So as I said, symbol for what we could be. Symbol allowing us to connect with our potential. Symbol of our potential. To get at that in a direct, non-conceptual way. Not through words, but through intuition and experience. And a symbol at the same time of what it feels like to meditate. What it feels like to meditate. So, the first thing we might notice about the seated image of the Buddha, which actually is really badly illustrated on this, never mind, is that usually the sort of an image of the Buddha is surrounded by an aura. He's got an aura around his head. Okay, but usually there's an aura. Usually goes around the whole figure. So there might be two auras as well. There might be a head aura and then an aura around the whole thing. So what is this? What's that getting at? It's not a sort of halo, you get auras in Christianity, it's sort of halo. It's not that. But what does it say? I mean, so an aura, it's sort of like separation. It's like the Buddha exists in a different dimension, separated from the world. He exists in another world, in another dimension. It's as though he really exists in another place, a sort of higher place. That's his real home. That's where he has his real being. He's in our world, but because of that aura, the world can't get at him. He's of the world, but free from the world. He's not limited, pushed around, constrained, affected by the passing events of the world. So, I mean, you get that very strong impression from that, from of aspects of the actual historical Buddha's life. The one that really springs to my mind is when he was dying. So he was dying, he's 80-odd, he's sort of roaming from place to place. He's got dysentery. He's saying to Ananda that the only time he feels comfort in his body is when he's meditating in a meditative state. But yet he's sort of trying to roam around from place to place. And I think if I was in that situation, homeless, ill, and 80, I might focus on me. I think I probably might focus a bit on being a bit comfy and like, just keep the punters off, Ananda. I'm not feeling very well. The Buddha, it's as though it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. He's really concerned. His concern is, it seems to be completely unconcerned, the fact that he's ill and he's going to die. His concern is for the guy who gave him the food that gave him the dysentery, that he shouldn't feel guilty. For Ananda, who feels really, who's his companion, who feels really sad. For people who come and see him, who might be deprived of a Dharma teaching, and he really wants to talk to them. So it's as though he's operating, you know, the fact that his body is about falling apart and about to disintegrate, well, that's not of the main concern, because it's as though he doesn't really, he's almost existing on another realm. He's almost existing in another dimension, where that body is just, you know, happens to be the way he manifests. So, yeah, this aura, it's like as though he's separated from the world. In our world, but the world can't get at him. And he talked about that, I mean, a little bit. He sort of said, there is an unborn, there is an unconditioned. And if it weren't for that, there would be no escape from suffering. There'd be no escape from the sort of end, you know, the sort of flashing, fleeting nature of this world with its suffering. So he sort of inhabits that. So another way, I suppose you could look at another way of this aura. You could say that an enlightened being, or all of us, we actually carry our world around with us. If we're in a good state, there could be all sorts of rubbish going on outside, but there we are. We're inhabiting our mental states. We're okay. You know, we're okay. It can be built beautiful and filled with light. So the Buddha has this aura, which seems to symbolize that although he's in this world, he really exists in another dimension. External events can't get at him, and he symbolizes our potential, right? So maybe this says something about us at our best, if you like, our higher selves. If we did but know it, at our best we live in this world, but we don't have to be ruled by it. We have some freedom in it. It's as though we really come from a higher place. That's our real home. And we can have at least one foot in that place, even while existing here, in that other dimension. That's where we have our real being. So events can come and go, and they don't have to be crucial to us. So we can have some freedom from that. And that sort of freedom brings us back a bit to the problem, the wheel of life. The wheel of life is a symbol of being completely thrown around by outer events. Outer events determine us, you know. Outer events are our likes and dislikes, our wants and our fears, throw us around. We have no freedom, we just keep going round and round the wheel, thrown around by outer events and our reactions to them. So the Buddha's aura, in a sense, that separation represents freedom, not being thrown around by outer events, not being pushed around by the outer world. And then, I mean, that aura, it actually figures really nicely in one of the stories from the Buddha's life, which is the story of Mara's attack, which Vajratara sort of alluded to, Mara's attack, which Vajratara alluded to last week. So the Buddha is about to get enlightened, and Mara, who represents our lower self, if you like, our reactive self, goes on the attack. And one of the things he does is he gets this army. His army attacks the Buddha. And this is like the army of all our sort of negativity, all our unskillfulness, all that stuff. And they start hurling their weapons at the Buddha. And then, but these weapons, as they hit the Buddha's aura, they all just turn to flowers and light, things like that. So it's a, they can't touch him. They can't touch him. All this negative stuff can't touch him. So I think that's an image we can use in meditation, that or that image of the aura and Mara's attack. When we sit in meditation, our mind, our reactive mind, will throw all sorts of weapons at us, like Mara's army, all sorts of unskillful states, all sorts of reactions, all sorts of unskillful thoughts. And if we envelop them in the aura of our awareness, we don't have to fight them, we don't have to run away from them, and we don't have to grab onto them. We certainly don't have to identify with them, but if we sort of, we can transmute them, actually, by our aura, by the aura of our meditation, and turn them into something else. So, I mean, I think that's a really good image to use in meditation when thoughts come up, you know, sort of quite negative thoughts. Oh, how dare they do it? Whatever. Or, fancy a bit of that. Well, it's just a Mara's attack. You know, if you just stay aware of it without grasping onto it or fighting it, it will turn into a flower or something else. I'd rather have a different image than a flower because flowers are a bit twee. But it'll turn into something really beautiful and really nice. So that might be quite a useful image when you sit in meditation. Mara's attack. The work is, your mind's going to be constantly throwing spears at you, but you can actually just turn them into something else. So, I think this, so we've got the aura, which he doesn't have, never mind. And then you've got the image of the fact that also this Buddha is not doing, is sitting on a lotus. Some Buddhas are sitting on lotuses. And that's a sort of similar symbol, if you like. The lotus symbolizes, lotuses are a sort of semi-tropical water lily. Okay. And they're great, they're like water lilies in that they grow in the mud and really dirty places, but everything just runs off them, just completely runs off them. So in a way, that symbolizes the fact that the Buddha is sitting on a lotus, sort of symbolizes, A, it symbolizes that existence in another world, sort of actually having your being in a different world where you can't be touched by things of this world in a way. But it also represents the fact that a bit like the aura, an enlightened being, well, stuff doesn't stick. It just runs off. It's like the Buddha is Teflon-coated. Yeah? Teflon-coated with regard to events, Teflon-coated with regard to negative mental states. They just run off. And we can be like that. We can be like that. Like a water lily. It just runs off. So that's similar sort of idea, really. So what else do we notice about the Buddha? We probably notice that he's usually sitting, certainly sitting cross-legged, or sitting in, very often sitting in a full lotus, which I don't recommend, but he's sitting cross-legged, full lotus, which has got a certain sort of feel to it. There's something very complete and self-contained about the full lotus. It really looks as though, you know, your energy is completely contained. You're sort of, you don't need anything from outside. You're absolutely enough for yourself somehow. Something about the energy. But also it's a very grounded posture. It's a very grounded posture. And this sort of brings this out quite well. I mean, there's a sort of real groundedness to this figure. He looks like he's growing out of the ground. So there's no loose ends anywhere. There's nothing sticking out or flying off when you're in the lotus position. And you're very grounded. You don't need anything outside of yourself. Your energy is sort of enough unto yourself. You don't need anything outside yourself. You're complete. And you're grounded. And traditionally, the lotus position is said to sort of also indicate detachment from worldly concerns, serenity, completely serene and unaffected by little transient wants and anxieties. So I'll come back to that groundedness a little bit later. The Buddha's also, he's usually shown in monk's robes, but that's harking back to the historical Buddha. But usually the artists they're not trying to portray a scruffy old monk's robes. Usually they look quite royal. The monk's robes on the one hand sort of symbolise renunciation, but they also, they look more like king's robes. And in some images, the Buddha is actually shown with a crown on his head, just to really bring that out. So there's a really sort of kingly quality or a royal quality. So the Buddha, our Buddha nature, is royal. It's kingly or queenly. I don't know if there's a word called queenly, but it's kingly or queenly, queen-like. That's who we are in our, at our best. We've got sovereignty. We're like sovereigns. Kings and queens, they rule and they bring harmony at their best. In a symbolic world, they might, real ones might not, but that's the sort of symbolism. They rule and they bring harmony. And our inner Buddha brings harmony and order to our inner world. So that sort of kingly, queen-like quality. So that's a few things. I mean, there's the Buddha's face. I mean, the Buddha's face must be about the most challenging subject in art anywhere. Okay, so you're a sculptor or a painter, and you're told, paint me a face that represents the enlightened being. Shish. It must be just incredibly difficult. Incredibly difficult. And very often, so the solution is to sort of almost go for a face that isn't a face. It's just sort of universal in a way. But and most artists don't really get it. How can you? And then it's all complicated by the fact that we've all got loads of cultural baggage around faces. What we consider to be a noble and et cetera face will vary from the culture, the race, et cetera, we come from. So, and we're always looking at faces from very different cultures to ours, where people are racially different from ours. So, it's quite difficult. It's quite difficult. And very often they perhaps don't convey what they conveyed in that culture. But sometimes they do. Sometimes they do, when they're really good. And I've seen one or two, I've seen a few Buddhas that really convey this. An amazing expression of serenity. Amazing serenity. Deep, deep calm. Deep calm of emptiness, of meditation. Along with warmth. And a sense of a deep and expansive inner world, but at the same time warmth and happiness and compassion. This one goes more for the depth, I think, than the warmth. You sort of get this with the head with this halo. There's a sort of like, the world it's inhabiting is cosmic. It's like stars. And a sort of introspective, sort of bringing out the innerness of the world. So, if you look at a selection of Buddhas, you will get different ones. Some definitely expressing cheerfulness and humour and compassion and things like that. Others, much more meditative. And this is a very meditative one. But generally, you'll see the face is attempting to convey something calm and completely free from tension. Usually with a slight smile, this one doesn't have, just to prove me wrong, but usually with a slight smile, eyes either closed or sort of looking inwards, almost having an inward gaze, looking into his own rich inner experience, or even with eyes open but seeming to look into a completely other dimension. So this is something we can think of in meditation as well. what is my face like? What is my face like? We very much meditate with our body. So it's really worth coming back to our face in meditation. You know, what's my... It's really interesting. I shouldn't say this because people get self-conscious, but occasionally when I'm leading meditation, I open my eyes. Very, very occasionally. Very. I promise never to do it again. But I have been known to open my eyes. And you see, some people... what is your face like? Your face says a lot about us, and we can work on how we are in the meditation with our face. Is it calm and relaxed? Are the muscles of the mouth relaxed? What about just having a little smile? Quite difficult to have a little smile and not feel smiley, I think. So that's something we can look at, you know. Eyes relaxed, forehead smooth, face relaxed, and just a little smile on the face, perhaps. Then the Buddha is usually shown as having a lump between his eyebrows. This one's got a sort of space into, looks to me like space into infinity, or a hole into infinity between his eyebrows. But he's usually got a protuberance between his eyebrows. And if you read Mahayana Sutras, this is a really important thing, because with this protuberance between his eyebrows, very often, at the beginning of a Mahayana Sutra, there'll be the Buddha sitting there, and there'll be sort of all sorts of beings. And then the Buddha will send out a ray of light, poof, and it will go, poof, and it will illuminate countless Buddha lands in the Eastern Quarter. And then it will go, boof, and it will illuminate countless Buddha lands in the Western Quarter and the North. You know, it's sort of like illuminating the universe, all these different world systems, all these different beings, all these other Buddhas teaching in these other systems, all sorts of dimensions of beings, from really horrible sort of places to really amazing God realms. And this is all being illuminated by the light from between the Buddha's eyebrows. It's really science fiction stuff. It's great. What does that mean? And it's very often, it's usually shown. That one hasn't got one. Never mind. The power of the mind. If you like, the power of the mind to illuminate. The power of wisdom to light things up. Especially the power of the enlightened mind. The fact that our mind is a whole world. It's a whole world and can illuminate world upon world upon world upon world, especially the enlightened mind can. The mind in meditation could be a window onto other dimensions, lighting things up. So that just that sort of cosmic element, if you like, of the act of sitting in meditation. Another thing that very often is shown with the Buddha is either a little top knot, sometimes a top knot of hair, sometimes it's sort of bony protuberance, and sometimes it's sort of becomes a spike, and sometimes it becomes a flame coming from the center of the Buddha's head. We've already talked about the sort of downward, the grounded quality of the Buddha, and different Buddha images convey this very, very differently. This one is focusing more on the grounded quality, and if it's the upward quality, it's getting it from the sort of cosmic look of the halo, if you like, of the aura. But very often there's a sort of real sense of upward movement in the Buddha image. The ones that really convey got a flame. A flame is a sort of upward movement. So you've got a combination of complete groundedness with sort of upward energy, which conveys something, I think, about the state of meditation. And that's something else that you can think of in meditation. Well, be grounded, be really grounded on the earth, but also have this sort of upward, be aware of the sort of upward energy through the body, lengthening the back, lengthening the neck, tucking the chin in slightly. And then one of the last things we maybe notice about the Buddha, which is what he's doing with his hands. So the use of the hands becomes a way of sort of pointing to different aspects of enlightenment. So the Buddha is traditionally shown often with a variety of different hand gestures that mean different things. So one of them, a very common one, is the gesture of touching the earth. So the Buddha is reaching down with his right hand and touching the earth. It relates to an episode in the Buddha's life when he was challenged by Mara, and he called the earth goddess to witness. So he's sort of, it's almost like saying, I am grounded on the earth. I am part of nature. You know, this enlightenment is not, it's not something grafted on. It's like, this is what nature is about. It's about evolution. It's about evolving consciousness as well as evolving life forms. I've got a right to be here. But also just groundedness. I am grounded. I am grounded on the earth. I am supported by the earth. So that's one you'll very commonly see, is this gesture of touching the earth. And each of these gestures sort of almost gets blown up into another Buddha at some time. So, you know, that gesture, you get another Buddha, Akshobhya, that just focuses on that, and mainly on that gesture. I'll talk about that some other time. Another one is the gesture of fearlessness that you sometimes see, which this standing Buddha here has got. Gesture of fearlessness. So the awakened human being, you know, us as we could be, is we're fearless. We're fearless. And we could give fearlessness to other people. We don't have to be prone to anxiety and fear. If we're in contact with our inner Buddha potential, if you like, if we're in contact with our inner Buddha nature, our higher self, this gives us fearlessness. And another really common one is that of giving, is the gesture of giving. Holding the hand down in the gesture of giving. So the enlightened state is a state of immense inner richness. And this richness overflows into boundless generosity. I mean, almost like you don't have to give anything. It just the state of being is a giving. The state of being is a giving. It's about giving. It's such a rich state that the enlightened being is constantly giving out. And I sort of relate that also to something that we haven't got in any of these, which is the begging bowl. Sometimes the Buddha is shown as having a begging bowl in his lap. And the begging bowl is usually seen as a sort of symbol of renunciation. But I think it's also a symbol of the fact that the Buddha and his followers and all Buddhists really are, and everybody, are completely dependent on other people. So the Buddha was completely throwing himself on the mercy of other people. It's not like, well, I made my money and I've got a right to it. It's like, would you support me? Would you support me? And in a way, we're all in that position. We're none of us self-made people. We're all supported by others. And that the recognition of that fact goes along with generosity, goes along with wanting to give back. So the Buddha made this point a lot to his followers. He would say, well, if you're not really practicing, you are wasting the people's alms food that they give you. You're not worthy of their alms food. You're only worthy of their alms food if you're doing it as much for them as you are for yourself. They're part of this, them by giving you food, they're part of this this project to move humanity towards enlightenment. And if you're taking it under false pretenses, well, you know, get out and get a job, basically. So that sort of recollection, that recognition of complete dependency on others, and hence wishing to make a contribution. So the gesture of giving. And then you get the gesture of meditation. We'll talk about each of these actually in more detail, but the gesture of meditation, sometimes like this, sort of very grounded, relaxed, sometimes like this, as though you're sort of holding space between your hands, so you're sort of almost holding a bit of the universe between your hands, like a bubble, holding the present moment like a bubble between your hands is what I've got written here, which I've forgotten. So, I mean, that's what we're doing in meditation. We're very gently holding the present moment all the time. Yeah? You can't really grab onto the present moment, because then you... And you can, if you let it go, well, it's gone. You're not aware of it. But we're very gently holding the present moment. In a way, the hand symbol strikes me as a symbol of that. If you if you try and use that, actually use that mudra, that gesture in meditation, you'll find that sometimes you'll notice your thumbs are like this. You know, ouch, that hurts. Because you're too tight. And sometimes you forget about it and it's gone. But if you can actually use that gesture as a guide in your meditation. Are you gently holding the present moment, keeping a gentle attention on the present moment? And the Buddha is usually shown seated under a tree, which Amoghavaksa sort of talked about earlier, often the tree of wisdom, the Bodhi tree, the tree that connects heaven and earth. So he's shown as seated on what's called the diamond throne, the sort of seat of enlightenment, which is the center of the universe, under a tree that connects heaven and earth. So the diamond throne, royalty. Diamond, indestructible, clear, and said to be the center of the world. So if we're open to the Buddha as a symbol, this connects us with our inner depths. And maybe our own inner Buddha can come and sit at the center of our world, our inner world, sending out their influence to every aspect of ourselves. So this idea of being at the center of things, sitting on the diamond throne that's the very center of things, and affecting things everywhere, is maybe, it's an image we can use in meditation, I think. It's also brought out by some other images of the Buddha's radiance. So the Buddha is sometimes shown sort of throwing off clouds of other Buddhas, which sort of gets across the idea that, well, the Buddha's not just in our mind. It's like everywhere. Anywhere we are open to the influence of our Buddha nature. So he's shown as radiating the small copies of himself. The Buddha is this sort of universal symbol everywhere. He affects everyone. Wherever we are, whatever we're doing, the transcendental Buddha, or our own Buddha nature, if you like, is looking for ways to communicate to us. It's affecting us. It's trying to guide us, to help us, if only we'll open up to it. and I think this idea also of sitting on the diamond throne is something we can connect with in meditation. Every time we sit in meditation, we're sort of sitting on a branch establishment, a franchise establishment of the diamond throne. Yeah? The seat of wisdom, the centre of the universe. And we're getting a bit of the echoes of the Buddha's enlightenment. So there's something incredibly mythic about sitting in meditation. It's not just some psychological exercise. It somehow connects us right back to the big bang that was the Buddha's enlightenment. And the sort of echoes of that sort of go down all the sort of branch establishments of the diamond throne on everybody's meditation cushion. So every time we sit in meditation cushion, we can connect with something of that. So that's a little bit of a high-speed run through the symbol of the Buddha. We're going to actually look at a few different aspects over a few weeks, like meditation, fearlessness, for example. But that's a bit of a high-speed run through it.